Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to the Fisheries Diversity and Inclusion Podcast. Fish are amazing creatures with a diversity of colors, shapes, and sizes. They truly are a diverse group of animals, and so are humans. This podcast is more about people than fish, which is also the case in fisheries, believe it or not. Any fisheries manager will tell you, it's about working with people. The fish are the easy part.
Here we focus on people and on extremely important topics, including the benefits of diversity, equity, and inclusion in the field of fisheries and aquatic sciences. Some topics may be uncomfortable at times, but this will be a safe zone from which everyone can learn. Although this is an initiative led by graduate students and supported by the American Fisheries Society and the Fisheries Podcast, it applies everywhere and to everyone and transcends fisheries.
We strive for everyone to feel involved and included, no matter your country of origin, age, ethnicity, gender, religion, sexuality, and or disability. Hosts and guests are sharing their personal views, which they hold as their own.
Humans struggle between what is right and wrong. Our personal morals and ethics are shaped by cultural norms and the ones that surround us, including our family, friends, classmates, and colleagues. Our podcast would like to critique your philosophy by challenging some of your personal beliefs regarding right and wrong.
We are so glad you chose to listen and open your mind to these very important conversations. Thank you for joining us.
Hey everyone, thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Fisheries Diversity and Inclusion Podcast. My name is Dion Kerr, one of our four co-hosts, and today I'm happy to present to you all an episode on financial disparity. Additionally, I would like to add that this is going to be my first episode without any other co-hosts, so I hope all of you enjoy. Financial disparity. As many of us know, financial disparity or income inequality followed by wealth inequality can be discouraging to many. Attending college after grade school is a big step. Typically, those who go this route are trying to achieve a career that not only the individual enjoys, but will also provide the cost of living for them. Financial barriers can be intimidating and discouraging. And today I would like to have a conversation about this topic and search for potential solutions so that those who feel discouraged and out of options no longer need to feel that way. Joining me today to give us his insights on the matter is Dr. Brian Sidlauskas. Brian is an associate professor and curator of fishes in the Department of Fisheries, Wildlife, and Conservation Sciences at Oregon State University. He studies the evolution of biodiversity, taxonomy, and conservation of freshwater fishes in the Pacific Northwest, the Neotropics, and Central Africa using morphological and molecular tools. Brian also is a father to a toddler, mentors several graduate and undergraduate students, has a species of fish named after him, plays various historical musical instruments, and is an expert on the systematics of headstanding fishes from South America. To my extent, he would be happy to discuss any of these topics. Brian, please say hello.
Hi, this is Brian Sidlauskas. It's a pleasure to meet you all.
Brian, I'm so happy to have you here today with me to discuss this topic and to give us your insights on it. And I just kind of wanted to start with asking you, what exactly are your thoughts on this issue? How do you feel about it?
Oh, I mean, it's such a big topic, Dion, and I'm really pleased that you've offered me the chance to come here and speak about it. I've got a number of things that we can talk about, but I think probably the most important one, or the way to sum up my overall feelings about this, is that if you're in a position like I am, where you're mentoring students at various levels, the most important thing is to just constantly keep an eye out for ways to support your students as best you can. And that often means being really engaged in making sure that you compensate your students financially for the work that they do, or being constantly on the outlook for sources of funding to begin to sort of shore up some of these inequities in opportunity. One thing that's become really clear to me as I start to mentor students at the undergraduate and the graduate levels at Oregon State is that not everyone is playing on the same footing, and that not everyone has the same opportunity. And for example, there is a strong tendency to want students to sort of volunteer. There's sort of a strong tradition in the sciences of students volunteering their time to get internship experience. experience or to get research experience or to get your feet wet in a laboratory and such. That can be really hard for someone that's financially insecure or it just isn't coming from the same background of a more privileged person. There's a lot of our students at Oregon State, and I suspect that's true at Clemson as well, that really need to be working 10, 15, 20 hours a week just in order to make the ends meet. And so like one really simple thing that advisors can do, or if you're hiring student workers, student researchers, do everything that you can to find a way to pay those students an hourly wage in order to make it possible for them to get the same experience that someone else might have the privilege or the ability to volunteer for. So that's just one example. And I've got, you know, several others that we can talk about. But yeah, probably the most important thing that an advisor can do is to be aware of the issue and, you know, not be blind to this. And then to take whatever steps that you can from a position of more power in order to provide solutions.
One of the things I guess that kind of comes to mind is I know there's opportunity for assistantships at the graduate level, and obviously combinations of TA and other sorts of forms of funding that can come into play for supporting a student financially. You mentioned giving an hourly wage. Now, would that also, so say a student was on an assistantship, would you consider something like that also? Or I guess what level of audience you're thinking that would kind of apply to?
Yeah, that's a great question, Dion. In respect to talking about an hourly wage, I was mostly thinking about the undergraduate experience there. Mm-hmm. At graduate level, financial support is also incredibly important. And I think it's very important for advisors when they're considering taking on new students to really have a solid plan for how to financially support that student's success in a number of ways. I mean, it's not just finances that help students to succeed. Yeah. But finances are a big one. It's really hard to succeed in graduate school if you're housing insecure or just not sure how you're going to pay for your research and such.
Right.
And so I would say that at the point that a advisor is considering to take on a student, you need to have a really solid plan for at least the first year and ideally substantially more than that. Where's the stipend coming from? Where is the tuition coming from? Where's the funding for the research coming from? You know, if it's not all in hand right at the beginning, you know, this shouldn't be a mystery in the sense that, you know, I don't know whether I'm going to be making a stipend next year.
Yeah. Yeah.
That really, really is critically important.
Absolutely. I did want to ask you what your thoughts were on individuals who might be intimidated by kind of going the next level. So I know originally when grad school was brought up as a thought for me mm-hmm. by other graduate students when I was doing my undergraduate, my first thought was, yeah, I'm not going to be able to afford that. mm-hmm. Until I was informed about assistantships and how funding works. Do mm-hmm. you think that concept to undergrads is kind of not mentioned much?
This is also a great prompt. As academics, we don't necessarily do a good job all the time of explaining our culture to people that aren't brought up in it. And it can seem like there's just this wall of uncertainty where people just don't know what professors do, what graduate students do, how to get involved, how does the support work. So I think overall we need to be doing a better job of conveying that information to a wide range of people that might be potentially interested in this as a career. In terms of, you know, what individual faculty can do or individual grad students can do, the most important thing is to mentor students, you know, and to sort of lead by example and to actually have these conversations with lab groups, groups of undergraduates, with your classes. You know, take the time in order to explain the way that these things work. And that could be, you know, a topic by that covered in a lab meeting in which you invite the undergraduates in a lab to join conversations. It might be an afternoon workshop. Right now, no one can be face-to-face, right? You could offer these things on Zoom. Mm-hmm. You could work it into a class on professional development. There have been a number of students that have come through my lab or have worked directly with my graduate students that have said that the experience of, you know, working closely with academics has opened their eyes to career possibilities that they just had no idea existed when they started their undergraduate or even when they started working for us or as an assistant to a various project.
Yeah.
And that's very reasonable. You know, if you're not brought up in a culture in which you know a lot of academics, then how would you, can we expect anyone to understand how that culture works? And that's true of any culture.
Yeah.
You know, we all get different cultures, so we don't necessarily understand each other's culture unless we talk with each other. And we've had several instances in which, you know, students that had never even considered graduate school have gone on to earn master's degrees and move on forward past that.
Yeah.
And it's just a matter of communication and encouraging people and saying that it's possible if this is what you want to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good point. I know I kind of fall in that category of being a victim of not really knowing the culture of academia or the graduate level, especially in the sciences, because it is, there's a lot of things that go on, you know, whether it's working on manuscripts, funding was a whole new concept, getting funding, writing grants. There's just a lot that goes into it. And you really just don't understand that or know of it. The more I think about it too, it falls a little bit on the undergraduates themselves at times to get themselves involved and to hear what professors and faculty have to say when it comes to kind of knowing this culture of going to the next level and learning about financial capabilities that you can acquire when you become a graduate student. College can be a tough decision for individuals just because of those kind of barriers there. You know, you kind of ask the question, do I want to take out all these loans and do I want to have all this debt? Is the education I'm going to get going to pay off? Do you have any thoughts on those types of questions that might come into young students' minds?
Of course, I'm a professor and an academic, so of course, I think that the investment of time and money is worthwhile, right?
True.
I would be involved in this. But I think it actually is really important to have conversations like these with students and sort of keeping the fact that everyone needs to find a career path in mind as we're teaching our classes and mentoring our undergraduates. There's lots of different definitions of success and lots of different ways to turn a science degree or really any degree into a career, but that shouldn't necessarily be a mystery. You know, it's important to find ways to let students, connect them with internships, to have conversations about career development, to encourage folks to pursue different interests, but also to be realistic with them about sort of what job prospects look like in different fields. You know, our students go on to do many incredible things, and there's a huge diversity of things that they do. It's not all just, you know, in the fishery sciences, conservation sciences, wildlife sciences, whatever you want to say it, there's not just one career path. It's a million different things that you can do. Of course, being an academic is one of them, but there's also a huge range of jobs at non-governmental organizations, all of the various state and federal agencies. People end up being science writers. People end up working at zoos or as vets. People start their own businesses. People work for consultancies. It just goes all over the map. Having conversations about what those careers look like, you know, inviting people in different careers to give seminars that you invite students to. All of these can, I think, help to illustrate the value of the degree and also illustrate the range of things that you can do with training in this area. And it's also important to have conversations about sort of what it takes to get these various positions and what the job looks like. You know, there's, again, how would I say this? As an entering undergraduate, or even as a beginning graduate student, it can be very hard to actually understand what the job is like for someone that is directing a non-governmental organization, or is working as a technician for, one of the state agencies, or what a professor actually does with their day. What do you even need? You know, what are the minimum qualifications for getting that job? You know, these things shouldn't be a mystery. There should be ways for people to get this information. Part of that is just being accessible to students, and part of that is opening doors and helping people network to help them find the people that can answer those questions.
Yeah, I agree with that. Dr. Ismindi mentioned that he helps out with a summer program, basically gets a younger audience involved and exposed to ecology. But basically, it can be kind of expensive. But he is saying that program does cost a little bit. As awesome as a program as it sounds, and I've seen the video of it on the website, it just kind of, you know, scares me that there are many of those who still might not try to apply to something like that because of the cost. What are some ways that would help reduce a cost for such things like that?
Okay, so there's a lot to unpack here, and this is a really, really good topic. So I think part of what you're asking about here is how can we increase access to these sort of wonderful experiential summer programs that get students excited about ecology, that build a network, that help them learn some field and lab skills, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Super important. There's a flip side that I think would be also worth talking about in sort of how we value that experience and how we expect it, which is a different issue. Let me tackle the first one first. Wonderful programs in many cases. And I actually don't know the one that Yvonne was talking about in particular, or maybe I do, but I'm not sure. But if Yvonne is recommending it, then I'm sure it's spectacular. No question about that. When one is setting up funding and the plan for such a thing, you know, one thing to really consider are issues of access and whether there is a way to set up the overall cost structure such that there is financial aid available to some students. I have certainly myself benefited from such things in the past. I remember when I was a young graduate student enrolling in a wonderful ichthyology course that was taught in Bermuda, and I could never have afforded that on my own, even though I come from a background that is more privileged than some. Certainly, that was maybe on my means.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was private foundation money that was available to help some students to do that. And so working with donors, working with fundraisers, saying, you know, hey, this is really important for our students to get this experience, and sort of prioritizing that as a department's fundraising effort can go a long way to increasing opportunities for students that wouldn't otherwise have things. It's also important for those of us who are seeking funding in our grants to keep the stuff in mind. And so maybe it's not that particular program, but you know, we're able to ask for money for research experiences for undergraduates or for money to pay student assistants in our labs or whatever else it is. So to think about these issues when one's seeking out money and to build ways into our funding sources or our funding requests in order to increase the access to science and to the ability to participate in science is something that all of us can do. And if we all chip away at this, suddenly there's a lot more opportunity for a lot more people. So those are basically my thoughts about that. There's the other side of this in that we've set up a situation in our field in which having access to a lot of these experiential opportunities becomes critical in advancing in the field. And that worries me to some degree, particularly when I start seeing things crop up. You know, every year, as sort of we start moving towards the summer, I start seeing these things crop up that are essentially pay-to-play internships in which some program or another is asking students to pay for the privilege of volunteering their time on one project or another. And they're usually conservation type projects, though not always. This makes me very uneasy because we're essentially asking students to contribute money to in support of someone else's project and someone else's research, as well as their time, and setting this up as a potential gatekeeping situation for those who get to move on in the field. That's not a good recipe for increasing equity and inclusion. And so I counsel students to try to avoid this, but it is a problem if when we're looking at who gets to advance in the field, we're really heavily weighting access to experiential learning. Mm-hmm. And so that opens up an entire different conversation about how we do admissions and how to think about more holistically about who we invite to join our labs as graduate students, you know, who we invite into various programs, how we hire people, and just, you know, probably an hour-long conversation in and of itself.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's a good point. It's tough. I like how you mentioned the structure of admissions too. I never really thought of that concept alone kind of lead to financial and also inclusivity when it comes to programs like that. That was a really good point that you mentioned.
Thanks. I really appreciate that. Yeah. It's something that we're beginning to really grapple with, I think, as our faculty, and I don't think we are alone in that. It's been a building surge to think really long and hard about how do we structure admissions to graduate school in the sciences and in academia in general.
Yeah. And I know it's changing a little bit with testing, you know, the GRE starting to fall out. That could be another issue that kind of comes into play when it comes to finances, is the cost of applying to grad school is really expensive. And it's typically on average around $60 to $80, depending on whichever university you might be applying to. You have people say, yeah, I've applied to 15 to 30 schools or even more than that I've heard. And I just think to myself, geez, where do you have the money to do that?
That actually ties into some of the cultural issues that we were talking about before, about who gets mentored and how the process works and who mm-hmm, doesn't. Mm-hmm. For graduate school, often you don't really apply to a program. You apply to a particular lab. And yeah. A lot of the current culture around admissions centers around having conversations with prospective faculty about whether they're willing to mentor you and whether they're willing to find the support for you.
Yeah.
Which is important. Like, supporting a graduate student is critical. Mm-hmm. But if no one has explained that culture to you, you can easily spend thousands of dollars, you know, sending applications to places that don't even have faculty that are necessarily working in the field that you want to work in.
Yeah.
or that have less full labs or whatever it is. And so, you know, it's a direct financial cost actually being borne by people that aren't being instructed in the culture of how graduate admissions work and how different that is from undergraduate admissions than those that haven't received that tutoring or that tutelage essentially can blow thousands of dollars sending out applications that have no chance of success, whereas someone that actually has understood the culture of trying to build a connection with potential graduate mentors before applying to a program have a higher chance of success and bear less financial cost.
I agree. And I think the biggest takeaway out of our discussion here today is the idea that for those who want to go to the next level and are worried about finances or might not necessarily be worried about it, but for the sake of just saving money, it's in their best interest to sit down with an advisor or a professor they like, or get to know a member of faculty, and to just ask these questions, try to get to know, like you said, the culture of how everything works. Because again, you make a really good point. As we've mentioned earlier, I don't think younger or newer individuals trying to transition who might want to transition necessarily know that going from applying to undergraduate is kind of straightforward. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to applying to graduate schools, like you said, you're not really applying necessarily to just the school. You really want to, it almost comes down to an individual lab. That's the difference of saving thousands of dollars or understanding that you don't need to spend thousands of dollars to make that next step in your life. So I think that's a big takeaway. And I'm glad that you've made it very clear to the audience that that's the approach that we need to take and to consider. Yeah, so I appreciate that, Brian. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Is there anything else on your mind relating to this topic?
I covered compensation, making sure that we pay people for their time. And that's actually something that I think I want to emphasize again. It's an undergraduate issue more than a graduate issue. But as we become faculty, I think we can lose sight of how much of a difference $500 makes.
Yeah. And
being able to work $500 or $1,000 into your grant to pay someone part-time to do work for your lab and to learn skills and to build those connections can make a really big difference to an undergraduate trying to get their foot in the door. And so, you know, don't be stingy with that money and do everything that you can to find it. There's quite a lot of internal granting opportunities at universities. It's usually a pretty easy sell with donors and funders. I mean, nothing's easy these days, but people want to help. And you can, you know, stress that this is a great way to make a big impact on particular students. Mm-hmm. I wanted to stress that. Also, at the undergraduate level, I wanted to bring up the cost of textbooks.
Oh, yeah.
Just think about open access. We can really, it's not even just nickel and diming students. I mean, textbooks can be $300 sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so as you're designing a course, you know, like, think long and hard about whether you really need that. And maybe you do. Yeah. Like, some incredible resources out there. But often there's a lot of stuff in there that you don't need for your course. And to think about low cost and open access resources, write your own materials. You know, what can you do to design the course in a way that students don't need to spend that extra money? Or if they are going to be spending money, that you can do something like field trips or experiential learning or something that may have more value for the students. Yeah. Again, it's not always easy. And I'm not sure that you can teach intro bio without a textbook. A lot of what we have been talking about has to do, honestly, with communication.
Mm-hmm.
And so a zero cost thing, at least in terms of finance, that managers can do is to just be accessible to your students.
Yeah.
That costs time and it costs energy, but it has a really big impact. You know, if you're someone that students feel that they can ask these questions to, and if students know that you're willing to find half an hour and sit down with them and explain these things to them, really positive investment on time, and it can help a lot of people out.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, being accessible, you know, being on a first name basis with students, you know, letting them know that you are a resource is something that everyone involved in academia can honestly can do. This isn't something that's just restricted to professors. Students can mentor students, you know, graduate students mentor undergraduates, senior undergraduates can mentor younger undergrads. But to sort of have a culture of communication and not keep these things secret, I think would be one of my major takeaways.
Yep, I agree.
Casting a wide net when you're thinking about who you want to have join your team is incredibly important. Yes, it's important for students to have to contact people and have initiative and all of those things. But remember that there are people that don't know the culture. And mm-hmm. so by posting widely that there's an opportunity in your lab, you may find that you get people applying that are incredibly well-suited to whatever it is that you need help with, but wouldn't have known about the opportunity or wouldn't have known who to ask without you spending the time in order to cast that net.
I agree with that.
And so that's hugely important. Many universities have undergraduate research offices or programs designed to sort of ease students into their first research experiences. Engage with those. Mm-hmm. Set aside money to help support those. You know, there's a lot of matching opportunities where it's like, you know, the research office will give you $500 if you come up with $500. Now you've got $1,000 for a student project. Makes a difference.
Big time. Oh, yeah.
Huge time.
That's equipment or travel money, you know, that
totally.
That can be used. Yeah.
It all adds up. You know, if you think about what a student needs to spend, even though at the graduate student level now, it's like, all right, you know, I want to do an annual conference or two. I need to go to my field site. I need some equipment. My laptop's getting old. You know, whatever it is, all of that costs money. And it's not, you know, it's not the PI's job, the principal investigator's job to provide funding for all of that, but to do what you can to fill those gaps and, you know, to help students apply for these things. You know, being available to read someone's application letter does not to say just go apply for grants, but, you know, write an application together and I'm going to mentor you in how to do this. That yields direct benefits. And the last thing on my list was a funny one, but it's buy your team lunch every now and then, which we can't do right now, at least not easily, because we can't see each other, to sort of have these social opportunities where the students aren't bearing the cost. It builds camaraderie in a lab. It lets people see that we're humans as well as scientists, and also it gets people fed.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a professor. I forget sometimes that, you know, $15 for lunch is not necessarily easy.
Mm-hmm.
But I try to keep that in mind, and to at least in the before times when I was actually able to see my students face to face.
Right. I never thought of it that way. And I think that's a really good idea to help someone out and to comfort someone, especially your students. I mean, that's your job. Well, they're the life of your job. So outside of research.
So, you know, it goes both ways. I don't want to isolate myself in my office all the time either, even if I'm locked at home all the time right now.
Right.
This too will pass.
Yeah. I did have a question though. What's your favorite fish?
My favorite fish is the one that's named after me. It's Leporinus sidlauskasi.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. I'll have to look it up. I don't think I know what the fish looks like. So I'm going to have to look it up.
It's from South America. It's got a stripe down the side. I think it's pretty. But hey, you know, it was named in my honor. And so I can't pick anything else.
Was it actually named in your honor?
No, it really was named in my honor.
That is so cool. That is so cool. I mean, that would have to be my favorite fish if it was named after me, for sure. But mine's a common carp. I have one other question, actually, before we end. So you said you play historical instruments. What does that entail?
Harps up on the wall. Those are recorders, woodwinds over there. like there's a lyre on the wall back that way.
Cool. Yeah. Where'd you learn all this? Like, did you just pick it up? Were you always into music?
I'm mostly self-taught on those, but I've had instructors on the woodwinds and an occasional lesson on the harp and that sort of thing.
No, okay.
Just a hobby.
That's awesome. Now, I always occasionally think about wanting to play a harp randomly. Was that difficult to pick up?
It's actually a really easy instrument to make sound decent. It may not even be in tune. I don't have much time to play with my daughter around. That doesn't sound so good.
That is so cool. I think you're the first person I've ever seen like physically play a harp.
It was multi-chord, but I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's played much like a piano, except with your hands in this position rather than
okay.
This position.
Yeah, that's awesome. Awesome. Well, again, Brian, I just want to say thank you. I know you're busy. I'm busy. I got to go start building more things for my own field work coming up. Awesome. Well, again, thank you. And I appreciate it. Have a good day, Brian.
You well.
Yep. Take care.
Special thanks to the Fisheries Podcast for hosting us on their established feed at fisheriespodcast.podbean.com and for also tackling important diversity and inclusion topics in their normal feed. Also, find us and other diversity and inclusion resources on diversity.fisheries.org. The custom lo-fi music beat was crafted by Darius Armstrong. Look for his music name, Karl Marx, on www.bandcamp.com/releases. We are very grateful to all those AFS leaders and members who have provided support and feedback as we have brought this podcast to life.